Kia ora koutou, it's 11 on Sunday. You're listening to Artbank.
Good morning, everyone. Hope you're all going well out there. Artbank on a Sunday, checking in.
Hello. Beautiful Sunday. Happy Mother's Day, by the way.
Yeah, happy Mother's Day. Don't forget that one. We've got a cool show lined up. We've got Graham here from the music department at Auckland University talking about Volume Exhibition, which is on at the Auckland Museum. And we've also got Malcolm McAllister in the studio. He's an art teacher out at Otahuhu College, and he's been over to Cuba, and we're going to talk a little bit about that trip and learning a little bit about what the Cubans are up to in the art world and how they're teaching art. Yeah,
really interesting stuff. And we've also got Theo's done an interview with
Olivia Blythe. Yeah, yes. So she's got she's just had an exhibition out west called Community Itty, and we'll be hearing a little bit about that. For now, let's talk to you, Graham.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you.
Yeah. So let's get down to the nitty gritty. Volume Exhibition is
1 week to go, folks.
1 week to go.
We get that in real fast. Yeah, it's up at the Auckland War Memorial Museum. It's called Volume, Making Music in Aotearoa, and yes, it literally finishes a week today, and it covers six decades of New Zealand popular music. So when you walk in, you're actually walking into the 21st century. One of the first things you see is, you know, Lorde stuff there. Like, there's her Grammy is actually there, but also the clothes that she wore when she accepted her Grammy, and the shoes are really, they're the high point for me.
Yeah.
Like, you go and see those shoes and you go, oh, what, you're kidding, you know, like those shoes?
They look like rugged sharks or something.
Yeah, so we shouldn't tell people any more about that, because that's such a funny thing. So yeah, you walk in there and that's where you start, and then you can walk back through the decades, but it's a very interactive exhibition as well, you know. Like, Sevilla's got a DJ booth there, and you can go in and you can mix some tracks, and there's a VJ thing that you can mix, and also,
and they're like, very well done though. They're kind of cool. Yeah, and it's a good insight for a novice like me into how to DJ or how to mix a band.
Yeah, and it comes up and it tells you, you know, don't quit your day job or something like that, you know, or, you know, God, you're a star.
Yeah.
So, all of that's really cool, and you can pick up ukulele and play that too. But also, and I always forget this because it is such a fun thing to do. You can go there and you can get your photograph taken and have it put on a cover of Rip It Up, you can choose the hip hop or the hard rock or pop or whatever. And I think that's a pretty cool takeaway thing. So what happens is that when you go there, and it is free if you live in Auckland, so university students just, you know, flash your card and you're in for nothing. Mm-hmm. You get a tag and you just go around, and you can actually collect music and film all going all the way around. Yeah. And at the end, you just type your name, your email address, and it all ends up at your house. So, you know, I think that's pretty amazing because, you know, the museum won an award, an international award for this, you know, the Spark Connection, because it is very, very interactive. And, you know, to have that sort of takeaway, these... You know, I don't know how many tracks you would get for free, but basically, I think you'd get a 60, 80 maybe, and then the films that you can look at, the 10-minute films that Paul Cassidy made.
One of them goes through each decade and sort of covers the ins and outs. And to be honest, I thought I was going to be in there for about half an hour, but I was there for a lot longer because that film just... such a good insight into
those films that Paul made, you know, decade by decade. Each of them is about 8 to 10 minutes long, or five to 8 minutes long, something like that. And they're all just snapshots. And of course, you know, my role, I should have mentioned this, that I was the content advisor for it. And about 18 months, maybe 2 years ago now, they approached me to say, you know, what do you think should be in there? And that was my job, to kind of, you know, give them the broad outline. And, you know, I thought in decades, but then, of course, that immediately blurs because, you know, how do you deal with hip-hop or how do you deal with reggae or R&B? You can't deal with it just as a confined decade.
Yeah.
So, you know, these things slide across decades. And so, you know, sometimes there were just, like, story threads in there. Other times, it's quite clearly, you know, the 1950s is a very specific and rather closed shop.
Yeah.
You know, it begins in, like, 54, 55, and it really ends in about 59.
Right,
But the interesting thing about that is, like, that was just really pure rock and roll attitude when you look at it. And, you know what it's like now. You walk down the street and there's a let's say there's a half a dozen 19-year-olds walking towards you, and one of them's got on a Nirvana T-shirt, one of them's got on a Pink Floyd, one of them's got, I don't know, Metallica, you know, and somebody's got Beyonce, you know what? All of that. Now, these are cultural identifiers. This is, you are putting a message into the world by the very clothes that you wear. Well, of course, you look at what happened in the 1950s here, and my God, those people were, you know, real outliers, weren't they? You know, the rock and roll rebels, the milk bar cowboys, as they were called, you know, there were killings based around rock and roll culture. So, you know, they were the rebel kind of their period, and even though when we look at them today and we think, yeah, they don't look rebellious, but then you look twice and think, yeah, but geez, they were riding bloody big motorbikes and they were wearing leather jackets.
They were sort of saying, who was it? Is it Dinah Lee? It was one of the Christchurch singers was saying that when she went into the city in Christchurch, people were wearing hats and to go into the city to do their shopping. And so for her to sort of have a short haircut back then was radical.
I mean, people dressed up to go to the movies.
Yeah.
I mean, we would find that just absolutely absurd, wouldn't we?
Yeah.
You know,
that
people actually got dressed up to go to the picture theatre on a Saturday night or to go out dancing. And when I do lecture here at the School of Music. One of the things I point out is that, look, you know, you can say that, you know, New Zealand was kind of a dead place in the 1950s. But in fact, there was a lot going on in terms of musical culture because there was no TV and there was only two radio stations. So people were going out to see bands. Well, of course, they were dance bands, jazz bands in those days, but that's what they were doing. It was a going out kind of culture. And, you know, I wasn't born here, but when we arrived here, my parents were very connected with the going out scene because, you know, we'd come from Edinburgh where people went out all the time. And, you know, they very quickly connected to the group of people here who, you know, ran restaurants and bars and hair salons and the models who were around at the time. It was a small scene, but my God, it was active. You know, there were always people at our house. That's what I remember when I was a kid.
And talking to people making this exhibition, is there what are some of the anecdotes and stories that have come out?
Well, of course, the amazing thing was that, you see, I was just like the content director, and then I worked with Victoria and Esther particularly up at the museum, saying, well, what artifacts do we need? You know, what's the objects? We don't want to be an entirely object-driven thing. It's not just, you know, stuff in boxes. I'm very happy to go to a museum and look at stuff in cases, but
if
you're 20,
that,
you don't want to do that. You want a feeling for it. So it was a matter of going out and finding objects that had a kind of narrative behind them. And, you know, I suggested a whole bunch of things. One of the first things I said was, well, we need split ends costumes. You know, you've got to have those in that exhibition because they were so unusual. You know, really nothing like them before or since.
Yeah.
And I don't just mean in New Zealand popular culture. I mean, I think globally the fact that they kept reinventing those clothes and that Noel Crombie and the group actually made those damn clothes, you know, that's amazing. So stuff like that huge Chris Knox painting, because you know, I was a caregiver for Chris for quite a few years, and I just saw that painting in the corner of a room covered in dust and said, man, that's got to be in there. It's just such a breathtaking. So in terms of getting these artifacts, one of the things that Victoria and Esther found, particularly Victoria going out to see people, is how generous people were straight away. People wanted to be involved. The musicians wanted to be represented because for many of them, you know, this had not happened before.
They
have made a contribution to this country. You know, they might never have recorded a single, but it is basically around recorded music. I have to concede that. There's a lot of that in there. But, you know, they made a contribution to our cultural life, and for the most part, it's largely been ignored. And here's an opportunity just to say, tip of the hat to you. You know, you contributed something. And so when people go, and I was talking to a young guy the other day, and I just shown the Sharon O'Neill clip of a song called Maxine, and in it there's a woman as a hooker, and That woman's dress is actually in this exhibition, you know, like the Maxine costume. Now, anybody who goes to that show just comes away with exactly the same thing about that. They go, Christ, she was tiny. You know, I said to this guy, yeah, that dress, I would use it as a wristband. You know, that's what it was just, you know, you look at that and you go, oh, my God, you know, how did anybody fit into that? You know, so those kind of things are in there. And And, you know, that's just sort of how the narrative kind of builds and people remember the video clip. The video clip, I think, is in there, if I recall. Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's a very sort of active, you know, exhibition like that. But, yes, the people were so, so generous. And the late Bill Savesi, lovely, lovely man who played for a very, very long time, you know, pedal steel guitar that he made himself, up at the Orange Ballroom, which has just been reopened about a year ago. Bill's family very generously gifted to the museum his lap steel guitar, wow, which is just amazing that they would have that now. Mm. And the purpose of this exhibition, I have to say, it came from Mark Roach at Recorded Music New Zealand, and you know, Mark is kind of head of special projects. And the question just kept coming up for all these people who have been inducted into the Hall of Fame, where can we go to this hall? Mm, mm. You know, and I remember Harry Lyon telling me, his late mother said to him, "Oh, Harry, you know, where's this hall that I can go to?" And of course, there is no hall.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a metaphorical hall, and we just need a literal one. And so Mark had this idea: let's try an exhibition of New Zealand popular music. We'll get it somewhere and see if people are interested.
Yeah, yeah.
Museum picked up on it straight away, and I can understand why, because it's something different for them. It's active. Mm-hmm. Everybody that I spoke to at the museum has their own story about, oh, yeah, I remember that. You know, I remember when hip-hop broke, you know, and I was so into hip-hop. And somebody said, yeah, I remember the 80s, you know, and this. And, you know, everybody had that kind of cultural memory, and so that everybody was into it.
I don't know if there's been such a collective feel for New Zealand music as sort of the days of the New Zealand Music Month sort of 10 years ago, when that was really thriving. In the last 10 years, I don't know if I've been aware of that sort of collective identity with New Zealand music as much, but it seems to be back with this exhibition.
Yeah, because it's big, you know, that's the thing, and you just look back at the whakapapa that's there, you know, like you know, the thing that I would say, and I'm talking about this next week with my student this coming week, you know, if you look at rhythm and blues, mm-hmm. you know, South Auckland rhythm and blues in this country, where does that come from? Well, you can just trace a line straight back, and you end up with people like the Yandel Sisters and Mark Williams, you know, in the 1960s, and of course, there were people before that who were doing sort of black soul rhythm and, you know, original rhythm and blues. They obviously didn't record, but, you know, the cultural memory in South Auckland about those people is huge, because I was out in Otara about 10 days ago for a meeting out there with some of the musicians, and, you know, it wasn't hard to get Ryan Monger, for example, from Adijah, just straight into talking about these groups that, you know, I'd never heard of the Grease Monkeys, but, you know, like, I would have loved to have seen the Grease Monkeys, because they did covers, but they played bars in South Auckland, and they were huge in that community. So we need to tap into that and kind of bring all that to the fore.
Mm. And is there anything that you sort of feel like you've left out that is really bugging you at the moment?
Oh, like, just totally everything. Heaps, bro.
Yeah.
Yes, of course. You know, I have to say this, that I presented the museum at one point with a 30,000-word document, which was the overview and what should be in it. Now, you know, I think that their jaws probably dropped at the size and depth of that. That document still exists, though. So if and when, and I sincerely hope we do get a permanent exhibition, that would be a useful guiding document, because in that there are all these other groups and, you know, side alleys and all that kind of thing that really deserve to be explored in much more depth. I think we got a decent overview of genres.
Yep.
You know, we got the sense of, okay, there's 50s rock and roll, there's 60s pop, there's 60s... I mean, there's a whole area of 60s alternative music which we really only scraped the surface of. Psychedelic music, you know, is just so bizarre and out there. So it'd be nice to see some more depth of that. But then, of course, you know, if I look around now, what I'm seeing is that a lot of new migrant communities have, you know, like the Somali people, Korean people here, they have their own hip-hop culture.
Yep.
And that's coming more and more to the surface. Yep. So, for example, I think that sort of stuff would really, you know, should find a place in whatever comes after this.
And can you tell us a little bit about what you have in mind? Is there a sort of permanent thing in the
Look, I wish I could tell you that it was my idea, but it's not. A tip of the hat to Mark Roach here, because Mark is the guy behind that at Recorded Music New Zealand. And there have been conversations about this. The difficulty is, and, you know, I know a building in Auckland, I think, oh, Christ, just give us that. You know, we can put this whole thing in there, and then we could have, you know, other special special exhibitions, Maori show bands, for example. You know, there's a whole Pacifica movement that was here with the Kyle Isles and those sort of people. I've seen the building. The only thing is, of course, you know, how do you buy that building? How can you get that building? Property prices in Auckland are just absurd.
Through the roof.
Yeah. Ridiculous.
And you need to have a big permanent space, which we would hope would have recording studio, rehearsal space, cafe and bar, a function room. You know, like that would just be the ideal, wouldn't it? You know, how many tens of millions is that going to cost? But, you know, the work goes on, and Mark is the guy who's going to be driving this, and I am absolutely sure something will happen.
Well, best of luck to you. We're going to hear a little tune. It's the La-Di-Das with How Is the Air Up There. Can you tell us a little bit about this number?
Well, you know, the thing is that you have to remember the cultural isolation that New Zealand kind of had in the 1950s and into the 1960s. In the 1950s, we were just living in a vacuum, really. You know, people didn't even know what Elvis, you know, looked like when he moved. It was just still photos. But in the 1960s, of course, we started to get rock bands coming through. I mean, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones played here, the Who, the Small Faces, all these people started to come through. So people in this country just got it. Oh, this is how you do it. And then bands like the La-Di-Das, Larry's Rebels, you know, the Blue Smoke and people like that, you know, they had a kind of rebellious, angry attitude about themselves. And I think the La-Di-Das just really captured it on something like this. So this is How Is the Air Up There, because it just begins with just this bloody great noise, and it's brilliant, I think.
Here we go.
Listening to Art Bank.
Tuned into Art Bank on 95BFM. I'm Tommy T and I'm here with Nadine.
Hello, hello.
We've got an interview that Theo's done with Olivia Blythe. She's an artist from Tamaki Makaurau and she's been working out with the Hapori crew at the Corbin Estate Art Centre. She's been doing a drawing workshop called Community Iti, and it's looking at how a community kind of works. It's really relevant and good work.
Good, yeah. Just kind of getting a whole lot of people involved in one singular project, which is really nice and so really inclusive stuff.
A lot of blindfolding and people kind of drawing the sounds that they hear, and you know, it's the kind of project that anyone can enjoy, and it's not sort of it's not how well you can draw kind
exactly.
of thing.
Exactly, it's about you know. What your input is and what you kind of interpret the audio to be and
slowing
like that.
Down yeah and just listening yeah. to the world around. So let's tune into that now, eh? This
yes.
is Theo and Olivia.
So basically, to do this community tea drawing, you close your eyes, you're ready with your pen and paper and whatever tool you want to use, and you close your eyes and you draw the sounds that you hear.
Oh, and you can draw the clouds moving too. And because the clouds change as they're moving too, it makes it fun.
So I started coming out here a couple of weeks before the drawing workshops were starting, and because I thought, well, if I'm expecting other people to come out here and to connect with a place, then I should come out and connect with the place and see if it was a place that wanted to be worked with or collaborated with. And and I found that straight away it seemed very talkative to me. Yeah, with lots of different things about. So like we could just hear Tui then. So there's Tui and Kingfisher, Kotari. And because Corbin's estate is kind of has a boundary of a stream, then you have all the different life around that stream and the bush, as well as people and the hustle and bustle of the train and transport around as well, lawnmower right now. So you get quite a wide range of elements within one community through these kind of sensory engaging drawing workshops. You can translate the sounds or let them pass through you. I think it was around December last year that Ayesha and Sarawat contacted me to see if I'd be interested in the being volume 5 of Hapori, which I easily agreed to because just with the sense of community and the opportunity to do a community project, and also the fact that they are, you know, have no fixed space. Yeah, I like that they have. And we just started to have regular meetings, and at the time I was finishing my master's, so quite often you know, that was in my mind and meaning to things.
It's a cool June morning on the edge of the city. It's so damn hot.
Yeah, we just had several meetings. I gotta find something to do about the thing.
And you know, the sisters on the boulevard, don't give me props, they're just too damn hard. Stroll right past them, roll right past them, even though they talk crap and make me wanna blast them. Because I'm chill, I have to keep subliminal, because I know my enemies are white collar criminals.
I find that,
in the neighborhood,
language there, but that doesn't, that
doesn't carry the true
You don't know me, you haven't seen what I've seen. So you could never really understand what I mean. I'm telling your child I got a major dose of punk. I'm sick with the flavor of the thick chocolate stuff, but a pessimistic attitude can get. So when the night comes, all you wanna do is play. So we roll to the club to see if we can get it on. Even if we don't know how we're gonna make it home. Cause once on the floor, we can really shake a booty. Shaking all our troubles away, doing the duty. Going on, keep it on till the break of dawn. Come every Friday, and I could have sworn I seen the same guy in the same shirt, 1-4, having trouble with the guys at the door. Cause everywhere we go, it's like a show. You gotta watch your back, because you never know.
Rolling in the neighborhood. Engaging and doing exercises like
so
this.
So that was In the Neighborhood by Sisters Underground under Olivia's request. So that song's also part of
what is actually
the volume.
The volume, yeah.
Yeah, the volume exhibition at the museum. And that's another one. That's OMC How Bizarre. We won't be playing that right now, but that's also featuring
another banger.
Yeah, another banger, and that's also on the volume exhibition. So I'm just going to jump straight into the second part of the interview with Olivia Blythe. Theo and Olivia caught up earlier in the week.
Well, one of the things about drawing sound is that you can't necessarily look at someone's drawing and say, oh yeah, that's clearly a tractor and that's clearly a tui.
Definitely when I introduce the drawing workshops, I try to encourage people to just go with like whatever their first instinct is when they hear the sound. And just to keep rolling with it, basically, that it is semi-intuitive and, probably more than semi-intuitive. And just to have some freedom and I think by working like that, you can actually have a lot of space and time with yourself. And I think that's a really important part of this project as well. So the soundscape can become very flat, but I think when you engage in a process like this, that you become aware of the many layers, and often your attention is taken to specific sounds, and I think everyone has will go to a different range of sounds. One thing I really loved about the workshops was that when people would come back inside with their drawings, they would say, yeah, this is, you know, and they'd point out on the drawing, this is when I heard a tui, and this is when I saw a magpie, and it was really beautiful to see that language in the paper, that experience that had passed. This is actually a way that I work, so whenever I start a project, I will always... And I work with place a lot. I will always go and just take simple tools and just start drawing through listening, through watching movement. I find it's a way to quite quickly pick up on patterns. You know, you're hearing the same sounds again and again, or maybe the sounds that come and go, but you start to pick up on the rhythm and the movement within a place. And when you become in tune with those places, you can hear when the rhythm's out, and you can kind of take a moment, go, well, you know, what is different here today? Like, what is up? In the past, I've used my drawings of bird calls to design lei, to make designs for lei or ula, and to gift to other people. So when I operate like that, then I can say, well, actually the place collaborated in this, like it's, you know, from the place as well. During this the time of this project, I work with a kaumatua and in one of my jobs, and he said to me that he was telling me that how a lot of the kauri in the villas in Remuera and places like that all came from where he comes from up north, and I just thought, whoa, I was like, which forest is my house? And I started to realise that our homes, you know, what constitutes our homes and builds our homes, whether it's, you know, cement or whatever, like, in wood, is actually that's come from a forest, it belongs to a forest, it's part of a, you know, has been part of a community. And I started to consider, you know, what forest is my home? Where did my home come from? And from that I started, from that plus the kind of inanimate aspect of, or the life force in inanimate objects, Māori and Wairua and such things, it made me consider that even though those trees have been cut and are in my home, they're still part of a forest and still hold the Māori of that forest. And so I just am starting to consider things like that. And through this project, by taking these drawings and, you know, drawing sounds of birds and movements of trees and people and other animals and, you know, whatever sounds are around, by putting them back inside, so here into the space that we had for the workshops. It's a beautiful kauri space at the bottom of the Corbin homestead. And by bringing the drawings in, it was kind of like a gifting to the wood in there, because I figured that the movements and sounds that we were drawing were things that would be familiar to the wood in there, and that it would be familiar to the wood and maybe art for the inside space, for the forest inside our home. Yeah. It just is a moment to stop and see, you know, how much of the forest we're still in, and just acknowledgement of resources.
Yeah. I quite liked that you could hear all the overlapping of the birds and the mowers and the, like, everything kind of just blends.
Yeah, I felt really sure about this space to come here to do these community ET workshops.
What is it, do you think, that makes language such a kind of continued interest to you?
Indigenous cultures are often still framed in a Western worldview, and so often the English language is used to describe and define the Indigenous world. I think here in New Zealand, English is the dominant language and we learn it at school, and I wanted the opportunity to I just found a place that I could change something a bit to suit me, but being someone of Indigenous descent, adapting an English word to better suit my view and maybe the view of others about what a community would be, for example, in my eyes. Anyone can engage in this kind of drawing anytime, anywhere. All you need is pencil and a piece of paper and you're off, basically. Yep.
You're listening to Artbank.
Prepare your classical string-loving ears. The NZSO presents Pathétique, a program of supreme string colors and heartbreaking melody. Featuring David Graham Taylor's Embiosis, a mesmerizing exploration of string sonorities and harmonies folded upon harmonies. Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 6, overflowing with unbridled rage, melancholy, and ire. And Dvorak's richly melodic cello concerto in B minor, conducted by Singaporean maestro Daryl Ang with international cello soloist Narek Haknazarian. NZSO presents Pathétique, Dvorak and Tchaikovsky. Auckland Town Hall, Sunday, May 27th. Tickets on sale now from Ticketmaster.
Ooh, the BFM Breakfast Club is back for May, and this time we've got treats. Come hang out with Mikey and friends at Real Groovy from 7 a.m. for bants and live music. Trapdoor Kalpi will be performing Screwed R&B at 8:15, and pop noise trio The Biscuits take time out from their Rise EP release tour to perform for us from 9:15. Grab a free cup of joe thanks to Coffee Supreme, and vouchers thanks to Burger Fuel, the 95 BFM Breakfast Club, from 7 a.m. Friday, May 19 at Real Groovy Queen Street. Thanks to NZ On Air.
Fresh from the kitchen, play it out. Every Wednesday on the 1 till 4 show with Bridge. Bringing in a sonically seasoned basket full of goodness, foraged from the musical wild, Bridge lays down a lovingly prepared meal for your ears. Three delicious courses from the same album, served up one by one throughout the show. Play it out on the Wednesday 1 to 4 with Bridge.
You're listening to Art Bank.
Kia ora everyone, we're back on a Sunday morning Art Bank. We've just had that interview with Olivia Blythe and Theo McDonald. Really cool to hear from them. One to watch out for, Olivia. I reckon she's going places, and all the best to her. She's a mate of mine and I highly respect her practice. Another person who I deeply respect is Malcolm McAllister. He is in the studio now. Malcolm's an art teacher at Otahuhu College, and I'm a student teacher there now, so he's kind of my boss. he's showing me how it's done in the classroom. We've actually heard from another teacher from Otahuhu College. Rose Tennyson came into the studio a few months back and talked about her practice. So nice to have another one up in the studio. Good morning, Malcolm.
Hi, Tom.
So you've just headed over to Cuba. And what were you doing over there?
Well, I won a scholarship at school that John Boscawen very generously and graciously offered to, for the first time, to any teacher who wanted to go and do some professional development overseas, as his father had done in the 60s in the United States. And I put in an application and I got it, I think partly because I'd done quite a bit of work to get Whakairo Māori traditional carving up and running at the school.
Yeah.
And so my interest really was, I had a long interest in Cuba since, you know, anyone who's a socialist has to be inspired by the Cuban Revolution and all its sort of heroic aspects and all its problems and its complexity.
And you've grown up kind of being really interested in all that.
For sure. Yeah. And tried to follow it. And when I went to art school in the early thousands, I made a study. My undergraduate essay was a study on Cuban, on political art in general, and how the Cubans do art, and also a little bit about the early Bolshevik period, which is also completely fascinating because it's all this stuff is kind of hidden. The Cuban stuff not so much, because Cuban art became very popular for collectors in the 90s, and it does have an amazing art scene, and it's worth studying just in its own right. But to get a sort of historical perspective on the thing, I did that study, and other collaborated a little bit with people in the UK and so forth who were interested in the same thing.
Yeah, and was the art kind of reflecting what was happening in the revolution, or?
Well, you just get a huge variety, you know. You get artists like one of my translators there who took us out to the art university and to another artist colony. He said, "My mother was a artist. She did her fine arts degree and her medical degree at the same time, just before the revolution. And she, when the revolution came, she said, I decided to put down my paintbrush and scalpel and pick up my machete." Yeah. And so she went out to cut cane with the peasants and that sort of thing. So you get, you hear these stories you know, amongst the few people that speak English to you, and you hear these stories from, hear many, many stories like that.
And did you find that you could kind of have those conversations quite easily in terms of the language?
No,
no.
That's the problem. To get a really, I mean, it's like any sort of serious study. If you, the more you know, the less you know. You know, you get there and you think, I'm going to try and nail this business about how they teach art. But yeah. When I got there, I found that no one had told me that the schools were in fact shut for the Easter break. So I never set foot inside a real classroom. However, I think it would be difficult to do that. In fact, if you think about it, it's not that easy to do in New Zealand. Someone comes from overseas, they can't just walk into a school. And the Cubans are a little bit, they like to naturally, because you have to always see it in its sort of global terms, that the revolution has been under fire and under attack, mainly from the United States, but from other quarters as well, for all its life. And they're a little bit defensive, and you know, they don't like to show any bad things. It's just completely understandable,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So, anyway, so I was, but I was able to get the Institute for Friendship with the Peoples gave me a really interesting tour when I first got there. They sent me to the oldest art school in the whole of Latin America, the San Alejandro Academy, and it's for kids about 15 to 18, and there was a class going on there. There was some Mexican kids that come over for for a workshop, and they were doing ceramics, and that was sort of fun. But I had a long talk to the director, you know, through my interpreter, and it was just sort of like, what stuff you wouldn't kind of expect from an art school here. It's completely different. It's very hard to get into, and like that's the most prestigious art school to get into. So like that, it's like a sort of an old 30s concrete building, but it's got a giant safety pin stuck through it at the top.
Oh, wow.
You know, and then there's this huge lino cut mural of this rhinoceros, you know, sort of 3 meters tall, and then in the in the foyer, there's a great big missile that's going into the dirt, you know, and you look up closely and it's all made of coins, you know.
Wow. Wow.
Stuff like that. You know, this is just a tiny glimpse. And I met one young lecturer who was, you know, he's like maybe 18 or something, and he was a stunning painter, very sort of sensitive and very clever. Anyway, you could just got a little feel for the sort of quality and the sort of...
So quite skill-based work, or were they
very conceptual. You know, yeah. Like, I'll give you another example. There's sort of tree roots chopped off and coming down from the roof and the corridors, you know, or... But then a sort of conventional but interesting in a way work, like a giant block of marble had been given to the kids and they carved a completely realistic sculpture of one of their cleaners who
wow.
they loved. This old woman sitting down reading, I think. And I thought, no way in the world you'd get an Elam kid doing the cleaner.
No way. No.
You know, it's a different sort of ethos and sort of outlook.
It's all very like monumental, the works that they kind of produce there, is it?
No, not in the slightest. It doesn't have, no. I think that might be a bit of a misconception. You think sort of revolutionary art, heroism, you know, the sort of Maoist, Stalinist sort of nightmare from the 30s to the 80s. It's nothing like that at all. It's extremely varied. There's always, Cuba's artists have always been able to get Western publications there.
Mm.
And their practice just reflects what's going on with installation, land art, whatever. Heaps of different stuff. They're all different. You know, all as different as anything.
And what about some of the artists that you met? Are there particular ones that...
Well, when I couldn't get into the school... Oh, I met probably Cuba's best known artist called... Cacho is his sort of name, sort of nickname, who's very popular, and he's this he runs this kind of, he calls it the he calls an organic museum in this extremely rough neighbourhood that even the Cuban police wouldn't go near. And he said, right, because he made a lot of money from art in the 80s. Yeah. Installations, drawings, all sorts of stuff. Anyway, he's about the immigration from Cuba and all sorts of stuff. He made his name for it. He made lots of money. And so he spent his money on renovating the local supermarket with the help of the local kids. And then he did a big opening with art pieces, and he sprayed them with mud and got them to act as statues and sort of exciting stuff like that. And then he turned this old factory that I think he leased off the government into this big sort of studio that fellow artists come and visit. And it's the only free Wi-Fi in the whole of Cuba that Google help him set up. That he invites the local kids from the neighbourhood to come in and have a go on the computers and stuff like that, cafe and stuff. So, and you talked and a big exhibition of Raul Corderas, Fidel's photographer, was up at the same time, which was very fascinating. But he's this sort of huge, giant personality, and sort of political. He's political. The few other artists I've met called him a communist, which I'm sure he'd be proud to be called. Fidel was his best man at his wedding and so forth.
Wow.
So it was cool meeting him, though he spoke Spanish extremely rapidly and I couldn't really understand how he was saying.
And are there any big drawbacks that you'll bring into the classroom, do you think, or is it just a slow process of working that out and thinking?
Well, it's not like a sort of bolt of lightning from the blue. I met three artists in their studios, and I was impressed by all of them. And then of course I had 3 days in Mexico City, and if people ever get a chance, you've got to see the giant murals in Mexico City. They're just stupendous, you know, and very refreshing, you know. And so, yeah, you can't help but buy. That's the great thing about a trip overseas, Boscawen. That's right. It shakes you up and gets you out of your rut.
Well, I'm looking forward to coming back to the classroom and seeing what you can bring from Cuba.
Terrific.
Otahuhu.
All right.
Okay. Cheers, Tom. Malcolm.
Thanks,
and
thank you.
It's really pretty much time for us to go. So I'd just like to thank you, everyone, for tuning into ArtBank. And any final messages from you, Nadine?
Yes. So we've got a couple of openings going on at Project Space. So this coming Monday, we've got Jorge Santana. He's got a show there, and the First Years of Elam are having a show on Tuesday at the George Fraser. So come round, and Elamite Zine is back up and running again for the month.
Okay, cool.
So hand in submissions before the 19th of May to elamite.zine@gmail.com.
Okay, well, fantastic. Cool. Cheers, Nadine.
No worries.
Cheers, BFM listeners. You've been great, and we'll be back next week. Up now is The Jazz Show.